In the study of the Bible, one of the interesting subjects is the study of typology. It is the study of types. The New Unger's Bible Handbook, in explaining that, says, quote, "A type is a double representation in action, the literal being intended and planned to represent the spiritual. A type is thus the divine impress of spiritual truth upon a literal event, person, or thing." One example of typology in the Bible is the book of Ruth. Today I would like to go through and explain the typology of the book of Ruth. This book has traditionally always been read at the Pentecost season. It has a great deal of meaning in relationship to overall what the Feast of Pentecost pictures and what it means. The name Ruth, just for giving you some information and background here, actually is a Latin word, Ruth. It is taken from the Greek in the New Testament, or the Septuagint. I don't know how you would say it in Greek, but it's R-O-U-T-H, Ruth, or Ruth, something like that, I guess. And the actual Hebrew is, Ruet, or something of that nature, R-E-U-I-T. So when you look at your English translation and you see the word Ruth, the name Ruth, you know in the Hebrew it's R-E-U-I-T. And it could also be a modification of a early Moabite spelling, as the commentary mentions. As I mentioned, this book was traditionally read at the Feast of First Fruits, or Pentecost. It is one of the five megalot, or festival, books in the Bible. You have the song, and I'll give you the five of them. And when they were read, the Song of Solomon was read at the Passover and Unleavened Bread period of time. Ruth at Pentecost, Lamentations at the Feast of Ab, which is 50 days before the Feast of Trumpets. Ecclesiastes, Feast of Tabernacles, is when it was read. And the Book of Esther at the Feast of Purim. Two of those, the Feast of Ab, Feast of Purim, Lamentations, and Esther, were for national festivals. The other three, I think as you all know, are for during the time of holy days. The Jewish Talmud says that Samuel wrote the book of Ruth. It was written in King David's time, by the way. We'll see later, but I'll just give you where you can see it in the book of Ruth. And the fourth chapter, verse 22, verse 7, shows that it was being written at the time of David, because it goes forward to David is the grandson, the great-grandson. Let me get this straight. Yes, no, the grandson of Ruth. She is the, I've got that mixed up without turning to it. He is the great-grandson of Ruth, because she and Boaz had a son named Obed, who had Jesse, who had David. And it's very interesting, the lineage, and how she is a part of the lineage of Jesus Christ. The time setting of the story is in the early days of the Judges. Let's notice here in Matthew chapter 1, and in verse 5, in the genealogy of Christ. In Matthew 1, 5, Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz begot Obed by Ruth, and Obed begot Jesse. And so it gives us a time frame there of when this took place. Joshua, by this time, has passed from the scene. So it is somewhere approximately in 1325 B.C. that the story of Ruth actually took place, around 1325. Now, let me give you a brief summary of the story. You have an Israelite family. The father's name is Elimelech. The wife is Naomi. And they have two sons, two married sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And they migrate to Moab because of a famine in Israel. While in Moab, the father dies. The two sons marry women of Moab, and soon, guess what? They also die. That is, the sons die. So the three widows are left. And they began to return to Israel, but one of them, whose name was Orpah, returns to her people in Moab. Ruth runs into Boaz in Israel because she came back with her mother-in-law, and he is a nephew of Elimelech, the father who had died. In time, he practices the law of a kinsman redeemer, which we'll look at as we go along, and marries Ruth. And she becomes a direct link in the family of David and of Jesus Christ. It's interesting how that in the genealogy of Christ, that there were individuals brought into it, such as I mentioned earlier here, reading in Matthew 1:5, you had Rahab. Rahab was a prostitute, right? Prior to the destruction of Jericho. And yet you see, what do you see if you look at some of the individuals in the line? The mercy, the forgiveness that God showed, and the humility of the individuals too. Ruth is quite an example, as you'll see here in chapter 1, something that even the Jewish people recognize, the statement that she makes to her mother-in-law, your God will be my God. And that's quite a statement to make. Anyhow, let's look at it, go into the book, starting here in chapter 1. In verse 1, now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. So they must have heard things were better in the land of Moab, so they went to dwell over there. The word Bethlehem, by the way, means house of bread, house of bread. And guess what? The bread of life would later be born there in Bethlehem, Jesus Christ. And even though he was of the city of Nazareth, but he was, as we all know, was born in Bethlehem. The bread of life, and it's the house of bread. In verse 2, the name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephratites of Bethlehem. Now, that doesn't mean they were Ephraimites. No, that was a term used for the city of Bethlehem, or not the city, but the village of Bethlehem of Judah, and they were Jewish. And they went to the country of Moab, and they remained there. Some of the types that we can see as we start in the story, because it is a story of types. Elimelech is a type of the Lord of the Old Testament, the Lord before the captivity. His name means, my God is King. Interesting how people were named. Naomi is a type of the Old Testament Israel. Her name means pleasant one, pleasant one. Mahlon's name meant sickly. Sickly, and that's what he would be. And Chilion's name meant wasting or pining, indicating also his physical condition. And Moab is a type of Israel being dispersed among the nations, if you want to look at the types. Verse 3, then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. So he dies, which is a type of the Lord of the Old Testament removing himself from Israel. You'll see these types as we go through here, and they'll become more plain as we begin, especially getting into Ruth herself. going on, verse 4. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so the women survived, her two sons and her husband. And then verse 6, then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. Well, Naomi hears that God may be found in Israel. It's a type of the time when physical Israel will set its face to return to God, really. You can see that as well. When you realize this is leading up to Christ, what's going to happen to Israel at the time? They're going to come out of captivity, they're going to be coming, and they're going to, which they're not doing today, but they will then, looking for the Lord. Verse 7, therefore she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each to her mother's house, and the Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. And the Lord granted that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband. And so she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices, and they wept. It's interesting, Naomi does not try to force her religion on her daughters-in-law, does she? Doesn't try to force her religion. The Moabites worshipped Chemosh. They practiced child sacrifices. Later on, I don't know if they were doing it at this period of time, may well have been. But she did not try to force her religion on them and get them to come with her. Going on in verse 10, and they said to her, "Surely we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. And if I should say that I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons." Verse 13, "Would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Well, that may be the way she would look at it, but did the hand of the Lord actually go out directly against her? These things certainly happened, because we see already by the names of the two sons that they were sickly children or young adults, and that for what reasons we don't know. In verse 13, it is showing here that God has withheld his hand from Israel at this time. He isn't saving all Israel at this time. That is not in his makeup to do. Even Paul said that in Romans 11 and verse 26, that Israel, all Israel, would be saved later, and not at this particular time. Verse 14, "Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her." So Orpah is going to take her mother's advice, kiss her goodbye, but Ruth is going to cling to her. Orpah means youthful freshness. She is a type of one who believes for a while, but soon goes back to the ways of the world. It's a type of that. And what do we see in the sower and the seed in Matthew 13? Matthew 13, verses 18 through 23. I've covered that before, but you have four classes. It's very interesting. Four classes of people. And that which the seed falls by the wayside, that which falls among thistles, that which falls among on stony ground, and finally that which falls on good ground. And you see a type of this here in the way that the reaction is taking place. As we go on in verse 15, "And she said, 'Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people,'" Ruth is what she's saying to Ruth, "'and to her gods,'" and to her gods, her religion. "'Return after your sister-in-law.' But Ruth said, 'Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God.'" What a statement there. Ruth, the word Ruth means friendship. She is a type of the New Testament church, as we will see when they get back to Israel here in the next chapter. And this is a type of faith and repentance that you see here, that she is considering everything. She says, "No, I'm not going to leave you. Your people are my people, and your God is my God." And assuming she had family, because earlier Ruth said, "Return to your mothers," meaning Ruth had a mother. And as the story goes, Ruth never returned to Moab after she married Boaz. So how does she ever find out? We always want to keep up with our parents, keep up with our family. We like to know what's ever happened. You know, a lot of times it's people leave and they never return, they never find out. And if I can just digress a moment, you know, it's amazing to me how people who back in the 17th century, for example, they would leave Europe to come to the New World, knowing they will never go back. They'll never, ever know whatever happened to their relatives, their families. and the founders of our country and everything, and came here and with just British colonies is what it was, and it's amazing, that seems so unusual, so for us, because how could we ever not want to know or even be able to have contact or even see our relatives and our parents and so forth while they're still alive? Anyhow, coming back now to the story, in verse 17, "And where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. And the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything, but death parts you and me." Now, this is she's a strong woman here. She has counted the cost. And this is where she wants to be, and she's not going to be talked out of it. And it certainly shows the faith and repentance that this woman has. And she didn't understand all of the things, but when we were baptized, did we understand all of the truth? No. We've come to more understanding since baptism. Did she understand everything about the religion of her? Well, no, she was married to her to the son for 10 years, right? And so she must have knew a few things about the God that they worshipped, Elimelech and Naomi, and possibly also her own husband until he died. Now, verse 18, "And when she saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her." Now, the two of them went. I would assume that what that means is she stopped speaking, trying to talk her out of it. Not that she wouldn't talk to her again, as though she was mad at her. That's not what it's implying. Verse 19, "Now the two of them went until they came to Bethlehem. And it happened that when they had come to Bethlehem, that all the city was excited because of them. And the women said, 'Is this Naomi?'" Now, 10 years have gone by. They hadn't forgotten her. It shows you how close-knit they were in the villages. You know, many times it's like it was in this country when we were much smaller, more rural. Well, it still is in some rural areas. Everybody knows everybody in town, right? That's kind of nice. Kind of nice. So she came back, and there were a lot of people, even though her two sons and husband were dead, a lot of people were excited to see her. "But she said to them, 'Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me.'" In my opinion, she does not understand everything in this case. I don't know that the Almighty has. The implication is that he has done this to her for some reason. So, feeling sorry for herself, she says here in verse 20, "Call me Mara," or bitter, bitter. She's very sad and probably very depressed because she has lost her husband and her two sons. Did God cause that, or did he simply allow it to happen? You know, it's like when you think of Elisha the prophet. He became sick and died. So did God strike him? No, I don't believe God doesn't say he did. But sometimes people will read into things that happen to them, and that it's of the Lord and he did it to me. And unless there is some real, it's almost like, I want to feel bad. I feel bad and I want to feel worse. you kind of use this kind of language like Naomi is using right here. Yes, it is tragic. We don't know what kind of Elimelech, what did he inherit? What did the two sons, by their names, were sickly. They inherited something, I would assume, that they were physically weak, and they just were not going to live a long life unless God gave them miraculous healing. Verse 21, "I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty." Not quite, not quite, because you have quite a daughter-in-law you're bringing with you. "Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" No, I don't believe he afflicted you. He didn't directly intervene to do that. Sometimes even in the church in modern days that I have experienced where people have thought, when an individual would lose a mate, I've heard the expression used by the survivor that, God took her from me. I just don't believe that. Why would he? Did he Is he trying to go after you or go after her? And we have these kind of expressions, and it's almost like we're blaming God. He did it. He certainly allowed it. He didn't stop it. But did he actually do it? No, I don't believe that. And I don't believe the Bible teaches that at all. But that's the way human beings sometimes, when they're down, will respond and make those kind of statements. Verse 22 say, Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. And now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest, which of course is in the spring of the season. And the barley harvest, somebody will probably cover that, either Mr. Rand or somebody else speaking tomorrow. When does it begin? It can't begin until you have the wave sheaf offering made. When? After the weekly Sabbath, during the days of unleavened bread. So that means it gets it very precise that it must be starting during the day. She was probably back in time for Passover. The barley harvest would begin whenever the first day of the week following the weekly Sabbath during unleavened bread fell in that particular year. So we see here as we go into chapter 2 a little bit more about it. There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. Now, Boaz means in him is strength, in him is strength. And it also means mighty man of wealth. Now, he is a kinsman redeemer, and we'll be looking at what a kinsman redeemer is as we go along here. A couple things that also I might add to this. A kinsman comes from the word, since we're getting into it, might as well stop right now. What is a kinsman? We don't have that in our culture today where this is carried out in any way by a kinsman. It's a relative. Even Paul makes a reference to one of his kinsmen in the, I think it's the book of Romans. Kinsman is from the Hebrew word gal, G-A-A-L, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. It means to redeem. How do you redeem? Well, you redeem by buying back. If somebody murdered one of your relatives in that period of the judges and there was no law there to arrest them or try them for anything, well, then the next of kinsmen was also the one who was the revenger for a murder that took place. That's why you have, for example, the refuge cities. If it was an accidental death, which you might call manslaughter today, but I think uses the example of a man, I should have looked it up, I guess, but I believe it's, as I remember right, where a person is swinging the axe and the head goes off and hits somebody and kills them. Well, it wasn't intentional, was it? The person could go to one of the refuge cities and be protected from who? The kinsman avenger. And because it wasn't a murder. It wasn't a murder. So the kinsman could also be a redeemer, buying back things. We'll look at this as later in, when we go along here. to the next of kin, as such, he can buy back a relative's property and he can marry his widow. He can do both. Because if he had a brother who died, as we will see, and had no children, his brother, the living brother, could, to be the next of kinsmen, could marry the widow and have children, and the children would be descendants of his brother who's deceased. And, of course, the same way with property, because God did not want property to leave the family. I think I mentioned it, a week before, the interesting thing about when you look at the economics in the Bible and the Old Testament and when they came into the land, God had the land divided and by tribes and by families in the tribes, and the land stayed with the family. And when you take away the land, then what can you do? You become a slave to whoever possesses that land. And but with that land, you can develop and prosper and become wealthy as Boaz did. Now, the word for kinsman here, G-A-A-L in the Hebrew, first appears in Genesis chapter 48 and in verse 16. I'm just going to digress here and go there. Genesis 48, and you see how it is used by Jacob. And in Genesis 48 and verse 16, its first appearance. Genesis Jacob says, the angel, notice the angel is a capital A. I think I've explained that before. You'll see small a or capital A. Capital A is for angel, who is what? The Lord appearing to an individual, either in a dream or actual coming to him, as he did with Abraham. The angel, capital A, who has redeemed me from all evil. Redeemed me from all evil. Well, how did he redeem him from all evil? That, by the way, is the same one who came before Abraham and later Isaac. And now Jacob here in his latter years is making reference to that. And bless the lads, and let my name be named on them, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And so he recognized who it was who had redeemed him. By the way, he wrestled all night with him, didn't he? And he is an individual who deceived his father to get the birthright. I get it mixed up here. The blessing from Esau gave it up. Actually, he had the birthright, and then later, this is chapter 25 of Genesis, and two chapters later in 27. Is where he literally deceived and lied to his father Isaac. And it was given by an oath that could not be taken back. And that's too bad, Esau. This is really what it came down to. But then he also gave a blessing to Esau, but nothing compared to what he was giving to Joseph. One thing about Joseph, he considered the value of it far more so and greater than did Esau. So this is the first place where you see that Jacob, later, when he's an old man, understands and recognizes who his Redeemer is. And we have a Redeemer. We have a Redeemer as well. And that's why it's interesting about how God set this up in the laws of early Israel, the kinsman Redeemer. And because later on, we would have a kinsman Redeemer in Jesus Christ. Let's take a look at a few other scriptures here about it. Let's go to Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25, and it's in the same chapter where you have the Jubilee, but it's not under the Jubilee. In Leviticus 25 and verse 25 and 26, if one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and if his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother sold. Or if the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself becomes able to redeem it, well then, let him count the years since its sale and restore the remainder to the man to whom he sold it, that he may return to his possession. But if he is not able to have it restored to himself, then what was sold shall remain in the hand of him who bought it until the year of Jubilee, and in the Jubilee it shall be released. And he shall return to his possession if he's alive. 50 years is a long time. But again, you notice how that God wanted to keep the land there with them. Verse 39, and if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. This is done in Israel. He is not to be compelled to serve as a slave. Verse 47, now, if a sojourner or a stranger close to you becomes rich, and one of your brethren who dwells by him becomes poor and sells himself to the stranger or sojourner close to you or to a member of the stranger's family, after he is sold, he may be redeemed again. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him. And that's who Boaz is in this case. He's an uncle's son to Elimelech. And so you can see the rest there. But it's very interesting about this. You look at the physical laws of redemption, our kinsman redeemer, and begin to think of it in terms here of what we're going to see as we go on here now in the book of Ruth. let's go back here to chapter 2. One other thing I forgot to mention to you, since we're talking here about Redeemer before we get into chapter 2, that today, of course, we have a Redeemer, Jesus Christ. But in the Old Testament, God was Israel's redeemer. God was Israel's redeemer, and he did redeem them on numerous occasions. In Exodus chapter 6, we see it here. Bringing them out of Egypt is quite a redemption, isn't it? In chapter 6 and in verse 6, "Therefore say to the children of Israel, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will rescue you from their bondage. And I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments." I'm going to redeem you, Israel. You've been there. You've been in bondage for centuries. And I'm going to redeem you. And so the Lord, the YHWH, Yahweh, he redeemed them. We have a redeemer today likewise. You'll find other scriptures where it talks about, repeats the fact that God is, he says, I am your redeemer, Israel. You'll see it in Psalm 77 and verse 15 and Psalm 78 and verse 35. All right, coming back now to chapter 2 of Ruth, let's take a look at that and see what happens with the redeemer and with Ruth. Verse 1, "There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth and of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz." He actually is a nephew to Elimelech. "So Ruth and the Moabitess said to Naomi," or Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Well, go, my daughter, yes, go to that field." Now, the best way you can understand some of this today is to go up into the Amish country of this Ohio and Indiana and Pennsylvania and see a little bit about this, because, of course, when you cut the wheat, the way they do it there is the way they did it in the Bible times, and that is they would cut it and then tie it in a sheaf. Well, that meant that there was still some left that they didn't get it all cut down. Now, of course, with modern equipment, we do a much more efficient job and everything today. But it does show a little bit about it. It's interesting, and when we were in for 7 years up in Ohio, and you'd go through in the early fall and late summer and see the harvest and that they're out there tying all of that, and you look at all these little stacks and rows, it's, you know, it's quite novel and interesting to us because we've never seen that before. Heard about it, but to see it is very interesting. Another thing, too, is to watch them in front of, you know, sometimes you don't like the traffic around here. You ought to have a buggy and a couple horses pulling, blocking traffic way back here and won't get over. Out on little two-lane roads that go up and down over hills so you can't pass. But it is interesting to see some of those things. The right of gleaning was conferred by a positive law on the widow and the poor and the stranger. And you'll find that in Leviticus 19, verse 9. And Deuteronomy 24, verse 19 and 21. But liberty to glean behind the reapers was not a right that could be claimed. It was a privilege granted or refused according to the goodwill or favor of the particular owner. When I read that definition, I thought of Nabal the fool. If you remember the Bible studies on David in the book of Samuel, would he have allowed that? I don't believe he would have, seeing his attitude. But this was a good law allowing for it if the person would choose to let them do it, because he still had ownership of the land and the crop was his. Yes, God wanted the poor, the stranger, and the widow to be taken care of. And if you were a good capitalist, if I use a modern term, yes, you will do well, and all the sheaves belong to you, but everything that's left, let them come along and have it. And so that they can have food and put provision and so forth away. God wants us to be generous in giving and taking care of others, but also to make a profit as well. And on the things that we've worked for and over the months, in this case agriculturally, that it took to bring to the harvest. Now, verse 2, verse 3, "Then she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come," it says something about Boaz. Boaz allowed, that's his field, isn't it? And he allowed these people to come in there after the reapers. He wasn't some hard person. I want all of it for me. No, it shows a little bit about his attitude and what kind of a person he was. So then she left and came to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Verse 4. Now, behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered him, "The Lord bless you." And then Boaz said to his servants, who was in charge of the reapers, "Well, who's this young lady?" Well, this young lady happened to be pretty attractive, too, as you might figure out. It caught his attention out there. Another reason, too, is usually you don't just see a young lady out there by herself, but joining in with the rest of them, who probably were older women, who were more than just young widows. One thing I forgot to mention, looking back here at my notes on verse 2 and 3 about gleaning. There is a type, because this whole thing, the story of Ruth, is a story of typology. The typology in this case of the gleaning the fields is a type of searching for the truth. Searching for the truth is how is what you would gather from that. The servants there are types of the angels. Small letter A, by the way. And find the example of, that you might compare that to in the parable of the tares in Matthew 13, verse 39. All right, let's go on down here, verse 6. And so the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered and said, "It is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab." And she said, "Well, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." She's asking that she can. And so she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house. And then Boaz said to Ruth, "You will listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go to glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close by my young women. Stay right here." Verse 9, "Let your eyes be on the field, which they reap, and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn." So she fell on her face, bowed down to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" And Boaz answered and said to her, "It has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and mother and the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before. And the Lord repay your work, and a full reward be given you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." These four verses, 8 through 12, is a type of Christ being kind and merciful to strangers. It's a type of being sanctified or set apart, as Boaz is setting her apart. Don't go to any other field, you stay here. It does tell us, Paul tells us in 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 13, we are sanctified, which means we are set apart. Boaz has set this woman apart. You know, many times you may ask yourself, I remember, it crossed my mind, I didn't spend a lot of time on it, but, you know, when I first began to really understand and study the truth and getting into the Bible correspondence course, you know, 46, 7 years ago, whenever it was. But I can remember when I first, even at the time I first began to attend in Portland, Oregon. You know, and that was a question other members that I talked with and everything always wondered, why did God call me? Well, I don't know. The answer's never going to be given. I don't believe in this life. And, I don't know if we'll ever know, in one sense. Maybe because it's not important that we do. But it is something that obviously, as you see it here with Ruth. Why are you showing favor to me? Look at all these others. Why are you showing favor to me? So you see a type here of something maybe that we have experienced as well. That she is asking a question very similar, just different circumstances. So why did God call me? But Ruth stepped out in faith. We see there in verse 11, as he repeats back to her what she has done, she stepped out in faith. That's one of the things that every one of us had to learn when we came into the Church of God. I had to learn before I ever even stepped foot in the door. I had to step out in faith when it came to the Sabbath. That seems to be the test commandment that everybody has to step out in faith over, at least in our time and generation. We are not being like 500 years ago in Europe. If somebody saw that we kept the Sabbath, we might be brought before a court of an inquisition, and if we didn't recant, we might be strung up to a post and be set on fire. And that seems so foreign and odd to us today, and yet it was quite real to people in various areas of Europe not too many centuries ago. But the Sabbath is something that either over job, and my situation as it was, because I had another God, and that was sports at the time. And everything revolved around the Sabbath. And that was something I, you know, it took me a while to come to the point where I was going to walk away from it. And I think everybody has to. This woman obviously considered everything when she was in Moab. She's a type of a Christian. She's a type of the church is what she is, as we're going to see. And she, after having thinking everything over and listening to her mother-in-law, she, this is where I'm going to go. This is where I'm going to go. And that's what I'm going to do. And that's what all of us have had to do. And a lot of times some people would never come to make that decision. Many times over the years, I remember talking with people, especially up in North Carolina and earlier up in Ohio, not so much down here, something with their brand new coming into the church. And they have an issue with their employer having to do with the Sabbath, that type of thing. And, well, you know, how's everything going? Well, I've been praying about it. Have you talked with them yet about it? Well, no. I know they wouldn't be happy with me if I did that, but I'm still praying that God will open it. Well, I'll tell you what, it's never going to happen. So there comes a point where we, yes, pray about it, but then we have to, after we get off our knees, we have to take some action and step out in faith to act on it. And that's a very, very important thing. As it, you know, you mentioned that, since I mentioned that, you'll find in Revelation chapter 14 and verse 12, where it's talking about in terms of the mark of the beast. And what does it say? To the saints who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. What is the faith of Jesus? What is faith? It is not only to believe, but to act on that belief. That's what the word is saying there in the New Testament. You have to have both. Faith without works, of course, is dead, isn't it? There has to be works to go with it. Coming back here, now Naomi stepped out, and she did have works to go with her faith in doing what she did, leaving her family, and here Boaz, you might say, brings that up to her. All right, let's go on here to verse 13. Then she said, "Let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants." In other words, I'm a foreigner. Now Boaz said to her at mealtime, "Come here and eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed parched grain to her, and she ate and was satisfied and kept some back. And you notice that the diet in that day and age wasn't exactly too broad. it'd take a while to get used to that, wouldn't it? And when she rose up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. Leave her alone, let her be able to do those things." And this is what he is saying in verse 16, "Also let grain from the bundles fall purposely for her. Leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her." Well, God blesses us without our being aware of it at times. Have you ever realized and looked back and could see that? His purpose is to convert us. God is pleased to bless one with such an attitude. You know, he looks at those attitudes, and he does bless people. The subject of healing came up here, when was it? Was it this week or last week? I can't recall now when it was we were talking or something. And one of the things, well, it was last week here at the potluck, I remember. I have seen some very interesting and profound healings when much younger in life. And when I look at this, and God does look at an attitude. And a lot of times some of those who have had some very, what we call astounding miracles of healing, I've noticed there have been people who are brand new and who really have that, what? That first love and that childlike zeal, but childlike faith. That childlike faith that you see, too. And I've mentioned a few examples that I've seen in the past here when I was talking on another subject related to healing. But here we see this woman who has this absolute, what we might call just a simple faith and belief and trust. And this is where I want to be. This is what I want to do. Your God is my God. And, you know, God blesses her all along as she's coming along here. She probably doesn't realize it fully that God's hand is behind this. God's hand was behind every one of us in bringing us into his truth and bringing us to Jesus Christ. We know from the New Testament that it is the Father who draws us to the Son by his Spirit. And we don't, I didn't realize it at the time. I couldn't figure out at the time why nobody else around me, that my friends in high school and everything, couldn't understand some of these things that I understood. And, their minds just weren't opened. But so there was something drawing me. It wasn't me or anything I was doing. But God was drawing me, although I did not realize it at the time, how he was doing it. All right, coming back here, verse 17. So she gleaned in the field until evening and beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an epaw of barley. Then she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw that what she had gleaned. So she brought out and gave to her what she had kept back after she had been satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where have you gleaned today?" In other words, she's done pretty well. "And where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." Then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "Blessed be the Lord, be he of the Lord who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead." And Naomi said to her, "This man is a relation of ours, one of our close relatives." So, yes, they spent a lot here to, of course, Ruth, or to Naomi. Ruth was not aware that Boaz could redeem her at this particular point. Verse 21, Ruth the Moabitess said, "He also said to me, 'You shall stay close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women and that people do not meet you in any other field, that you stay here." We also might relate this in typology as a type of being protected from Satan the devil. What do we see here? You know, God is protecting this innocent woman in one sense of the word, as we might look at it, from what? Being affected by anything that would turn her into doubt. And a lot of times when people are coming into the truth and they're receiving it, well, go back to the parable of sower and the seed. Some falls by what? Among thistles or whatever. What would that be a type of? Well, Satan trying to put doubts in their mind. You don't want to go there. You don't want to do that. In fact, you know, a lot of times relatives or coworkers or whatever will say, you must be crazy to get into something like that. That's just Jewish. That's just Old Testament. You know, God allows it in one sense, a persecution like that over what are of our new beliefs that we're not yet really fully founded in. Why? I'm going to put you out there and just let Satan take you away. No, because you know what? I'm going to turn those lemons into lemonade. Because I'm working with you, and as a result of that, you're going to dig a little deeper and prove a little bit more as to whether whoever said this to you, whether it's a relative or somebody at work or whatever, so that you will know. You will be stronger in the end. You'll be stronger. So I know God's hand is still there. Is still there, and he's still working with him. But you see this here. In a lot of cases, he does have to, and he does protect us from Satan before we have ever fully come into the truth or come to Christ or even realize it. In verse 23, so she stayed close by the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of barley harvest and wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law. Of course, the end of the barley harvest would end here on what we now call Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks as it was then. It had three names: Feast of Weeks, Feast of Harvest, Feast of First Fruits. All three there in the Old Testament. All right, now we begin to move a little closer or a little bit further on into the story and what's going to be taking place here as we go into chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you?" Now, if you have a center margin, you notice that security is really not the correct rendering. It should be rest, rest. The rest will be in marriage. Marriage, of course, with Boaz, as you know the story. Hold your place here. Let's go over and take a look at a couple scriptures here in, about rest. We certainly see it in Hebrews chapter 4, there is a rest, and there is the keeping of a rest. In Hebrews 4, and of course Paul would use this, taking a lot of this from Psalm 95. "Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. For indeed the gospel was preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, but being mixed with faith in those who heard it. For we who have believed do enter the rest." And she was coming, and Naomi is a type of the church. We, the church who believed, were entering into this rest. Israel didn't believe. They didn't enter into that rest, the promised land. "And as he said, so I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest." God has a rest for us. He had a rest, a physical rest for Israel. He has an eternal rest for us. "Although the works were finished from the foundation of the world." Well, you can go on and read here a little bit about it as you go on down through to verse 10. And, of course, the keeping of the Sabbath is a weekly rest. It's butchered here in the King James, New King James. "There remains, therefore, a rest for the people of God." Is not correctly translating into the English the word sabbatismos. There remains the keeping of the Sabbath. And that word sabbatismos is in Greek literature, meaning the very same thing. And although this is the only place it was used in the New Testament. And then you have the marriage supper of the Lamb in Revelation chapter 19 and in verse 7. The marriage supper of the Lamb is entering into the eternal rest, isn't it? With Jesus Christ. Coming back here then to verse 2. "Now Boaz, whose young women were with him, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." Winnowing tonight at the threshing floor. Or he is, in other words, he's sifting it there. There's an analogy of that in Matthew chapter 3 and in verse 12. The sifting of the wheat or the winnowing. And to separate the chaff from what? The good from the bad. Verse 3, "Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself and put on your best garment and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking." Now, you my first thought is, well, maybe this can kind of be a little dangerous thing to be doing here. No, there's a little bit more to it. And it certainly is not, because apparently Naomi knows not only that he is a relative and a nephew, but he is a man of character. person of character. So she, in this case, would tell Ruth to go down and to lay at his feet. Lay at his feet, as you will see as we go along here. But again, the analogy has to do with us today and being at the feet of Jesus Christ. She is actually, in verses 1 through 3 here, instructing Ruth in the law of the kinsman, redeeming the land, and of the marriage of a widow to her brother-in-law. And that, of course, we've already read is in Leviticus chapter 25. The inheritance was not to leave the family in any way. All right, verse 4. Then it shall be that when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in and uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. And she said to her mother, or said to her, all that you say to me, I will do. And so she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. And after, interesting, her obedience to do exactly as she was instructed, and after Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. And now it happened at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. Well, I bet he was a little startled there in a situation like that, because he probably had been working in the evening, that he was went to bed hot, sweaty, and everything else from all that he was doing, and then wake up around midnight, somewhere in the middle of the night, and guess what? Here's this woman who he had already talked to at one other occasion. But as it shows here in verse 8, you know, rest comes at our Redeemer's feet. It really does. And, of course, we have peace and rest in Jesus Christ. Verse 9, and he said, who are you? And so he answered, she answered, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. And then he said, blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich. No, you didn't stray away. That's the type there. You didn't stray away and go after other religions and begin to be enticed by them. It would be the type here. Verse 11, and now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. You're a woman of character. Now it is true that I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. We have a problem here. Stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that if he will perform the duty of a close relative for you, good. Let him do it. But if he does not want to perform the duty for you, then I will perform the duty for you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning. In other words, you certainly can stay here until morning. So this woman, Ruth, understood and knew where salvation came from, though she felt very undeserving, is what she is saying here. There's a scripture in the book of John. I'll come back here to finish up the book of Ruth, but it's in John chapter 6 and verse 68. What does she see? A type of what is she saying here? John 6 and verse 68, quite a controversy was taking place, and many of the disciples left Jesus. In verse 68, but Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. You have the words of eternal life. There was no place to go. Nobody else was teaching and giving the words of eternal life. And so that's why they stayed, even though others, because he had just previously asked, are you going to leave too? And that was Peter's answer. And no, coming back to the analogy of the story here, of the book of Ruth, that is exactly what you see here with her. And now verse 14, so she lay at his feet until morning, and she arose before one could recognize another. And then he said, do not let it be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. Also, he said, bring the shawl that is on you and hold it. And when she held it, he measured 6 epahs of barley and laid it on her. And then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, is that you, my daughter? And then she told her all that the man had done to her. And she said, these 6 ephahs of barley he gave me, for he said to me, do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And then she said, sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out, for the man will not rest until he has conducted the matter of this day. The business of this day, of course, is going to be here in chapter 4. And coming to the point, he has to go as the kinsman and the redeemer. But there's another one who is closer, who can do it. And, you know, it has to remind you, I would think, of John chapter 10. Because in John chapter 10, the good shepherd and the hireling, the type of the hireling doesn't care that much. But the good shepherd does. You see, I think, the analogy right here between the two kinsmen. Verse 1, now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, come aside, friend, sit down here. So that he came aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. He wanted witnesses to this. And he said to the close relative, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know. For there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am next after you. And he said, I'll redeem it. But he didn't know he also had to marry the widow and also produce the children. There's a difference between this redeemer and Boaz, who is going to redeem Ruth. And it shows you what kind of a redeemer we have. It says we're married to Jesus Christ. The church is his wife. It is more than just a business relationship or a handshake type thing. It is intimate. And it is forever. God the Father loves us. Doesn't it say he so loved the world, of which we have come out of it, that he gave his only begotten Son? That who should ever believe upon him, meaning not just believing, but doing, should not perish but have everlasting life. Now the world in the future, they will have their understanding to that as we understand. But when we look at the point, you know, in a marriage, we have an announcement here of marriages today, of anniversaries and so forth. A marriage is based upon what? A handshake or love? It's got to be love. And that's what we have in the relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's the way it is, not only with Christ, but with our Father in heaven, who wants us to address him as Father. And that type of relationship. So we should always remember, especially if things maybe have not been so well with us over whatever it might be, that God loves us. Jesus Christ loves us. It is not just a relationship like you read here as a document or something. It is an intimate relationship, and it is forever. And so going on here, the first redeemer, he thinks everything's fine. Sure, I'll take the land. I can have you stand to have some more land. Verse 5, then Boaz said, on the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth, the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. Now you could just see this other redeemer. No, wait a minute, what's this now? And the close relative said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. You redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. I forgot to mention to you there was an interesting point about the kinsman redeemer before we go to verse 7. If you had two brothers, the one brother gets married, does not have any children and dies. The other brother is to, as the near of kin, kinsman, to take the widow to be his wife, to have children for his brother who's deceased. But what I forgot to tell you was, what if he refuses? And you go back there, she is in front of the elders of the tribe, come before him and spit in his face as a disgrace. As a disgrace for not perpetuating the name of his deceased brother by having children by the widow. And you can see how serious this was, the law of the kinsman. And that was practiced at that time. Quite interesting, of course, looking at the parallel to our kinsman that we have. Our kinsman carried out everything. He did what? His father's will. Did his father's will. Verse 7. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm anything. One man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was a confirmation in Israel. That is an interesting, see if I can find it here in my notes where I got my pages here maybe mixed up, but it is a very interesting thing of the sandal. Yes. In Psalm 60 and in verse 8, casting down a sandal, it was symbolic of taking possession. And God says, I'm going to turn to it here and I'll come right back. Psalm 60. Sometimes people don't think, well, there's things in the Old Testament are really silly or whatever. Actually, it wasn't. It's a matter of understanding the customs of the time and how this was looked upon. And Psalm chapter 60 and in verse 8. But you, O Lord, shall laugh at them. You shall have all the nations in derision. What am I doing wrong? Oh, I'm wrong chapter. That's 59. Chapter 60, verse 8. Moab is my washpot. Over Edom I will cast my shoe. And Philistia shout in triumph because of me. That is also repeated in Psalm 108, verse 9 and 10. So here we even see it. And that was not David writing that psalm, by the way. Well, wait a minute. I think it was. In that case, I need to go back. I just flipped my pages back. But the point is, God is saying, I cast down my shoe on Edom to possess it, to possess them is what it is. All right, coming back here, let's finish up. Verse 8, therefore, the close relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. So he took off his sandal. And Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Eli Melech's and all that was Kilian's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from his position at the gate. You are witnesses this day. So it's all being done legally in this manner and in this way. And he has bought her with a price. And the price was not only the money for the land, but marriage and have children to perpetuate the husband's name and his position at the gate as he would have had he been alive. And it's all done. And I take off my sandal. This is instead of signing on a contract that the lawyers drew up. This was understood before the witnesses. It is official. And I take possession, is what he is saying. Jesus Christ, when we have come to him and accepted him as our Savior and repented of our sins, he takes possession. We are his. We belong to him. That's why he said there, 1 Corinthians, is it 6:21? We have been bought with a price. We've been bought with a price. Ruth, in this sense, by the kinsman, was bought with a price. And it was not just a matter of a possession. It was a matter of a relationship of which love was involved, just as it is with Jesus Christ with us. Let's finish up here. Verse 11, and all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses, the Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, and the two who built the house of Israel, and may you prosper in Ephratah and in the and be famous in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman. Now, that's an interesting statement right there coming in. Now, you may recall in Genesis 38 that Judah, Tamar was his daughter-in-law, but his son, Tamar's wife, had died. And so she didn't have any offspring. And, of course, she pretended to be a prostitute, and he was on his way wherever he was going, anyhow, out in the wilderness somewhere. So he had relationship with her and had twins, didn't he? What's the other one's name? Zerar and Perez. But where is it Zerar? Why is Perez only mentioned here? Because Christ comes through the line of Perez. Zerar, the other brother, they have even left the area by that time. Verse 13, so Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and when he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. And then the woman said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a close relative, and may his name be famous in Israel. And may he be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons has borne him. And then Naomi took the child and laid him on her bosom and became a nurse to him. And also the neighbor women who gave him a name, saying, there is a son born to Naomi. And they called his name Obed. And he is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now, this is the genealogy of Perez. Perez begot Hezron, and so on. You can see the line of the two twins from Tamar. And it was the Perez line that would lead all the way down here. In verse 22, Obed begot Jesse, Jesse begot David. Now, whoever wrote this would have written it during the time of David, but not during the time of Ruth. Otherwise, how would he have known anything about Jesse and David? So, obviously, it was written at the time of David, and tradition says it was Samuel who actually wrote the book of Ruth. Well, this is a story that pictures the redemption, the marriage of Jesus Christ to his church at the end of the harvest of the first fruits, which we are coming to tomorrow. And we should be encouraged by this story. It shows Christ's love for all of us who represent his bride.